I'm going to start 1 John, and now I'll have to give you books next week because I don't have them tonight. This is from the overview on 1 John before. John, the beloved disciple, was apparently the youngest of the 12 apostles, probably lived the longest into his 80s or early 90s. After leaving Jerusalem, probably just before the fall of Jerusalem, in other words, the 66 time frame, between that and 70, during the large Christian diaspora prior to 70, between 66 and 70, most Christians left Jerusalem, and many Jews left Jerusalem at that point. That's probably when he moved out. Now remember, Jesus had told them in 33-ish that they needed to go out and teach all the nations, and most of them stayed till 66. So they spent the next 33 years apostling in Jerusalem, which is not what he asked them to do, except for Peter and Philip, and who was a deacon, not an apostle. John eventually made his way to Asia Minor, specifically to Ephesus. Ephesus became the center of the Christian world after the fall of Jerusalem, not Rome. Rome was the center of their enemy during this time frame. And the bishop of Ephesus, Paul, started Ephesus, and Paul spent 18 months in Ephesus and did a hub and spoke kind of thing out of Ephesus he was able to do that because Prisca and Aquila came and joined him in tent making, and so it became the center. It was Asia Minor, what we call Turkey. So John goes there and basically takes over from Paul. He becomes the bishop of Ephesus. With him in tow is Mary, the mother of Jesus, if she's still alive. History records that he was a longtime bishop of Ephesus and therefore southeastern Asia Minor, or it was known to the Romans, Asia. When the Romans talk about Asia, they meant Asia Minor. They didn't know China from Hmunaptsut. The second most famous work after the fourth gospel was known as the Book of Revelation, and it was addressed to the seven major churches of Asia Minor. History and tradition tells us that John was the younger brother of the Apostle James, not to be confused with James, the Lord's brother, or James the Lesser, who was one of the other apostles. Their father was Zebedee, a fairly well-off fisherman from Capernaum, who owned boats and kept hired servants, according to Mark 1. Their mother was Salome, who was traditionally believed to be the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So they were cousins. That would make Jesus, James, and John cousins. There were actually several others who possibly could have been cousins as well. This is supported by the very bold familiarity shown by them all to Jesus. Salome, James, and John all presumed to ask for exalted positions in Jesus' coming kingdom. The nature of James and John caused Jesus to refer to them as the sons of thunder, a reference that would be dishonoring if Jesus did not know Zebedee familiarly. Jesus, from the cross, asked John to care for his mother, an assignment that was usually given to a close family member. John, known as the beloved disciple, was thought of as receiving preferential treatment among the apostles and was considered one of the inner circle, along with Peter and John's brother James. These three were all the transfiguration. They were the raising of Jairus' daughter. They were asked to comfort and support Jesus as he suffered in Gethsemane. Peter and John were often sent out together to address early church issues. They were referred to by Paul as the pillars of the church. James was martyred fairly soon after Pentecost Sunday. Herod, trying to gain the favor of the Jewish people, takes James, John's brother, not James the Lord's brother, not James the Lesser, and martyrs him. So after Stephen, he would have been the second martyr. John wrote later than most New Testament writers, and he addressed issues that had arisen toward the end of the first century, such as Gnosticism and Docetism. Paul and Peter were already martyred by then in AD 67. So John was basically the last of the eyewitnesses. If, in fact, Thomas was in India or Persia and all these other guys were somewhere else, they were probably already dead. But certainly in the area of the Bible, he was the last of the eyewitnesses. Pride-filled, arrogant, false teachers were coming out of the woodwork claiming to have private special information given to them from God, coming into the churches. Special revelation, gnosis, Gnosticism. Only John was left to give an eyewitness account in order to refute them. People would say, Jesus did this, or Jesus did that, or Jesus said this, Jesus said that. Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, blah, 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 blah. And John would go, nope, it didn't so. And, of course, he's believable, because he was there. He was the last of the eyewitnesses. In the Greek world of the day, ideas were considered more important than historic facts, which were sometimes seen as either mythic or anecdotal. Does that sound familiar? Don't confuse me with the facts. Typically, in John's area, their heresies were based on the Greek notion that all matter was evil while the spirit was basically good. Back up to that other thing. Do you ever notice when you listen to people on the news that they're absolutely sure something is true when you know for a fact it's not? Or another place where this shows up is when people send you stuff from the internet that said this and this is what's happened. They're passing a bill in Congress next week that Christians are all going to be massacred. You got to write quickly to your congressman now. I think they've estimated that somewhat 60-70% of what goes through the internet is false. I tell my friends, don't send me that kind of stuff. And those who don't listen to me, I block them. I have good friends, so I can't get emails from them because they just, you know, we talked about this in another class, but when you pass on a lie, you're a liar. When you pass on a rumor that it's unsubstantiated, you're a rumor monger. And that includes both the lies that say that they're getting ready to kill us all, or there was a kid in New York who blessed two puppies and they became four. I mean, you know, some sweet little story that somebody's got that's just not true either. The church has down through history been absolutely destroyed by what's called gloss, pious fallacies, things that are sweet but not true. In Vatican II, the church eliminated, 300-400 saints that they said, we have no real proof these people ever existed. Because down through history, whenever somebody died and the people liked them, they would just, oh, they're saints, and they just proliferated like crazy. The same thing is true like with relics. They estimate there's enough relic of the true cross floating around to build several major fort walls around New York. Same thing is true with bones and stuff like that. In the Greek world of the day, ideas were considered more important than facts, which were seen as either as mythic or anecdotal. Typically in John's area, their heresies were based on the Greek notion that all matter was evil, while the spirit was basically good. This resulted in two equally erroneous doctrines, antinomianism and docetism. In John's churches, certain intellectually elite members began to believe they had been given a new higher understanding or gnosis of the gospel. You remember, there was a man who went into a cave and he said an angel appeared to him and gave him a new religion and took him up to heaven. And remember his name? Mohammed. That one kind of got away, didn't it? There's a lot of those people. So that's what they were dealing with. And today we still deal with antinomianism a great deal and some other things. These Gnostics, they were called, had special revelation not available to the hoi polloi. This special understanding allowed them to live above the law and do as they wished in the flesh. Their attitude was, or hence antinomianism, which means normlessness. Their attitude was that the flesh is going to pass away. Anything you do in the flesh doesn't really count. So as long as your spirit is right with God, then do whatever you want in the flesh. Now, if that sounds crazy, remember we got people running around the church today going, I have a good relationship with Jesus, so who I sleep with doesn't matter. And other things like that. I have a good relationship with Jesus, so I can revile the bejabbers. You know, Rush does. Rush and Jesus, they're pretty close, aren't you? Gotta be. And yet, the Bible tells us that reviling is among the highest, worst of sins. Antinomianism teaches that we are saved in the spirit only. One can live in the flesh however one chooses, even leading a profligate life. Certain believers with self-proclaimed true knowledge, or Gnostics, thought of themselves as elevated above and exempt from the morality required of the common man. Now, how many David Koresh's do we have and Jim Jones's, you know, who will tell you, it's, you know, I have a right to go to bed with any of the women in my group because I'm above it all. I'm above all that. And it's not just Jim Jones's. unfortunately, too many people in authority have done that. Harvey Weinstein's. And all sin was covered in the blood of Jesus anyway, they said. So let it rip. In 1930, Nazi Germany, Bonhoeffer called this ageless and popular notion cheap grace. Cheap grace. Even today, there are those who feel that no matter what we do, a loving Father will accept us all into heaven. Docetism taught that God the Father would never have made anything as repugnant as a material world. Gnostics believe that the material world was made by a demigod or a demiurge named Yahweh, who was 136 levels of archon below the original God, and that Yahweh was not the Father of Jesus, but the original God was the Father of Jesus, and that when he made the material world, he made it either as a mistake or as a sin. If that sounds familiar to you, that's because it's part of the basis of Mormonism. So they thought that God would never participate in anything material whatsoever. So therefore, Jesus could either not have been human, he was divine, but only appeared to be human, docetism. Doceo means to seem or appear. Or that he was human, but only appeared to be divine. Or that he was human, but he was only divine for a period of time, that the divinity entered into him at his baptism and left him at the Garden of Gethsemane, because God would never participate in anything that happened on either side of that. That's called adoptionism. That's a theory that went through the church like a virus down in the old days. There was a point in time when over half of Christendom was Arian. In other words, they believed that Jesus, that he was divine, and only appeared to be human. Over half the church. And the reason why that was true is because there was a time from about 500, even up until the Renaissance, and even beyond that to some extent, when whatever the king was, the people were. So even later on, after the Reformation, when the king was Protestant, the people had to become Protestant or die. But in the early days, if the king was an Arian, then the people became Arians. And if the king was Orthodox, then the people became Orthodox. And kings didn't like it if he was Orthodox and you were Arian, so he'd kill you. Asceticism. One of the responses to this issue of material world is evil is asceticism and stoicism, which means don't get anywhere near anything physical, despise anything pleasurable, despise anything. And asceticism, it's kind of like a thing. There's self-control, that's a good thing. And then there's run away, do whatever you darn please. And asceticism, which is over here, which is not just self-control, it's like avoid anything and everything to do with that which is human. Augustine of Hippo, the greatest of the Western Church Fathers, said the only problem with procreation is you have to get aroused in order to do it. He said you can't help it, you just got to do that. Augustine had a little problem with sex. Anything material was unworthy, evil. Yeah, you couldn't be an animal lover. They wouldn't get it. If you liked your dog, you were just as bad as if... anything material, yeah, because they believed that all that was a mistake, should never have happened. It was done either illegally. There was actually several theories about how it happened, but they both involved God figures screwing up. Plato. Well, remember I told you that Plato was based in sort of innate knowledge, and Plato and many of the ancients believed that the idea that there was a God was innate in us. And, you know, you can't argue with that a whole lot, okay? Because Paul said, what can be known about God is evident. Then they set out and began to try to explain the cosmology of heaven. And so what did the Greeks and the Romans do? They got Jupiter or Zeus and then Hera and all of these trickle-down gods, Mercury, Poseidon. That's what the common people's version of that was. But they got all of that from their philosopher theologians who told them that there was this one God, and that he emanated or sort of thought into existence the sun and then what we would call the spirit. It was actually Logos and the Nous. And these were called aeons. There was about seven or eight of these. And then he emanated or thought into existence archons. And there were an archon was an archangel in charge of a whole bunch of angels that he emanates himself. And one of those would then emanate a new group. And there was 365 levels of these. Oh, they're discerning it. It's Gnostic information. It's like,
revelation to them.
I mean, it's like, what was Muhammad thinking? Muhammad wasn't trying to fool anybody. He just got in the cave and prayed, and this is what he came up with. And it wasn't like there was just one guy doing this. You know, they would get together and they'd talk about it and talk about it, and they come to this. Meanwhile, over here, there's this group of Hebrew people, Israelite people, who are learning who God is from Sinai and all this other stuff, based on the testimony of their patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But those people who lived in Egypt as slaves, they were just as confused as these other people. It wasn't until Moses came and got them out of there and started telling them, you know, what you were taught by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was truth. Because remember, when they were coming out, what were they taking out with them? Their gods and their goddesses, their idols, okay? Yeah, and they, you know, and every time they got in a bad way, they create some new ones. Remember, let's go back to the gods of Egypt and wheat, leeks, and garlic, you know. So God takes them to Sinai and spends a great deal of time trying to explain to them what the truth is. And he's got to do that because the world's over here doing what they're doing. There's about 9 different creation stories floating around, most of which have common elements, but they're just different versions of it. All you got to do is listen to the dialogue on the news, and you see that 51% of our people feel this way about an issue, and 49% feel this way about an issue, and they're both damn sure. I can't watch the Academy Awards because it's just such a blatant political situation. I can't watch it. I just want to know who won the picture. But no, you know, they got to. We're getting this constant drum in our society of this is true, this is true, this is true, this is true, and you're going, what are they smoking? But they're serious as a heart attack. They believe it. When you talk about the masses, probably an average person in the masses gives a good hour of his life to studying this. The rest of it he picks up from the guy who knows, or the internet, or the next door neighbor, or whatever. I mean, Paul said to Timothy, study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman who needed not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. In other words, there's this command for us to study the Bible. And remember I was talking earlier about philios and agape and all that kind of stuff. We are called to understand this. And the process of understanding the Bible means understanding the text and the culture and the history. Now, admittedly, not everybody can do that like some of us do, but that's why there's commentaries, and that's why there's Bible studies, because the people who do the work, if you trust them, they can bring you the benefit of the work so that you don't have to do all that work yourself. But you see, the problem is you're responsible for who you hear. If I'm listening to Rush describe the world for me, I'm going to get a polluted vision of the world. Yeah, we're all quite capable. I'm just talking about these 18th, 19th century philosopher theologians and what they're coming up with. If you get a really good look at church history, the history of the world, what you come to as a conclusion is you better get into your Bible and figure out what it says, because you can't count on anyone who's gone before you to tell you the truth all the time. You can't do it. And some people have spoken the truth and some people haven't. And almost no one speaks the truth all the time. Because all the church fathers, they were like orthodox about this, but then they had this, this, and this that they didn't agree with. You can say, okay, Jefferson was a good guy, bad guy. Well, he was a good guy on some issues and a bad guy on others in terms of thinking. You know, same thing is true with Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was a deist, and yet his best friend was George Whitefield. That was his best friend. So he was fully aware of evangelical. And when when they're having this trouble, can't get along in Congress, and when trying to get the Constitution passed, he gets up in the middle of this thing, the deist, and he says, in times past, when we have gotten into trouble and we can't agree with anything, we have gone to see the Almighty to talk to him about what we should do. And he's brought us this far. And it seemed to me that a nation that rises like this cannot develop without the help of that same Almighty. So the deist, who's not an evangelical, nonetheless believes that they should pray every day before they deliberate in order to find God's will, because otherwise they're never going to come to any kind of conclusion. So what you get is, I wouldn't agree with 100% with everything Billy Graham said, although most of it I would. But I'll tell you what, you know who doesn't agree with everything Billy Graham said? Franklin Graham. Because they have a couple of places where they differed theologically. As Billy Graham got older, he got a little bit more liberal. And Franklin Graham is still real almost fundamental in a lot of ways. And frankly, I don't care.
Yeah.
Well,
and was Stephen the one that Paul saw?
Yeah. Okay. Held their coats.
Okay.
That's Acts 6.
Acts 6.
Okay. Well, it wouldn't have been terribly long. Remember that after Jesus died and raised from the dead, that there was a hubbub for a while.
Right.
And then it settled down, and because of what happened at Pentecost, and because of the strong witness of the apostles, and because of the charity with which they handled one another, remember they gave up what they had in order, because of all that, they gained favor in the community, and because James the Just was their leader, they could trust him, because he was a well-known Pharisee. And so there was this period of benevolence in there. And we're talking about a good year plus or so, probably. But then Paul begins to stir up trouble. And he goes to the big guys and he gets letters to go out and hunt down. And so Stephen gets martyred. All right, we got to quit. So other comments? Somebody pray us out.